Guillon. I'm very curious to know whether you've come across jurisdictions, public health jurisdictions, who were pioneers or inspiring in taking on these challenges, either in Canada or internationally.
Public health?
Jurisdictions, institutions.
Not exactly. There are people, I mean, I was one of the founders of something called the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, which I don't think has a lot of public health members, actually, the public health physicians, but it has a lot of family doctors and other specialists and so on. So there are organizations like that that are focused on these sorts of issues. There are pockets of leaders, so you get folks down in the States. I work with people like Howard Frumkin and Dick Jackson, who've worked on healthy communities and worked on global ecological change. There's a group that Australia actually is quite a hotbed for this. There's a lot of work going on in Australia. So people like Colin Butner and Tony Capon, and of course the late Tony McMichael, who was the real, in many ways, the source of a lot of this thinking and the inspiration for a lot of us. And he wrote a book called Planetary Overload back in around 1992, which spelled out a lot of this. So there are, and Australia's had quite a strong history, I think largely due to Tony ever since, and still does. So there are pockets of it.
Well, thank you very much, Trevor, for a troubling yet inspiring talk. And of course, you spoke to this directly and indirectly, but I would ask you directly to speak to the problem of sectoriality in all of this. And of course, we're talking two major sectors in the world, in our governments, health, environment. And I can't help but wonder your pleas for us to include this in the public health agenda. But I'm wondering whether we shouldn't rather be using our public health expertise within the environmental agenda instead. So we really sort of have two choices, and I'm wondering if you could speak to your thoughts about the best bang for the buck policy-wise for us to work with environment, or for us in public health to integrate environmental concerns into what we do.
Yes. So my tendency when presented with two choices is to pick both, because I don't think it's either or. We have to do both. There is no point in us trying to go out to the environmental sector if we haven't got our heads wrapped around this. Although one way to get our heads wrapped around it, on the other hand, is to go work with them and learn. On the other hand, they definitely need us. I mean, I've worked in and with and around environmental organizations for 40 years, and they're always glad to have public health there, or help the health perspective there, in large part because people relate more to human health impacts and concerns than they do to the loss of some trees or some insects, or, you know, it's sort of not us and it's a bit more remote. So they're always happy to have us there. We just haven't been there very much and enough. So I think you have to do both. We have a lot to learn from them. One way to learn it is to go work with them. But they need us to go work with them anyway. But we also have to get our own head wrapped around it. So it's not on the curriculum, for example, in schools of public health. It's beginning to be a little bit, but it hasn't been there in a major way. We have focused on the social to the exclusion of the ecological. We need to get that balance right. And we also need to understand there's a huge component in here of environmental justice, or environmental injustice, actually. And what we see time and again, and we see it at small scale and large scale, is the benefits go to the wealthy and the costs go to the poor. And that happens globally on these issues as well. So, and I also think the other thing is you have to approach this both as a public health professional but also as a citizen. So what are you going to do in your own neighborhood, in your own school, or your kids' school? How can you bring these things together? And certainly in the whole of the Healthy Cities movement, there's a lot of reciprocity between healthy cities and sustainable cities. And I get a bit worried about it when they insist that, you know, healthy cities is what we need, not sustainable. I mean, actually, the other thing I'd say around sectorality and the divisions, one of the big things that we actually talk about quite a lot in the report, and I haven't touched on here, is we have to change the way we measure things. We have to change the way, as a society, we measure progress in particular. Right now, we measure progress by GDP. You know, so how's the economy doing? How much has GDP grown or not grown? All of that. Well, apart from the fact that GDP, when it was developed in the 1930s, Simon Kuznet was very explicit in saying you can't judge the social welfare of a nation from its economic activity. That's, in fact, was ignored, and that's what has happened. GDP is a totally stupid, mindless way of establishing a policy objective or measuring anything, actually, other than economic activity. But it doesn't tell you anything about social well-being. So we need to work on, what are we actually in the business of? If we're in the business of human well-being, human development, we need different ways to measure that.
Une question concernant la. Nous savons de l'ONU qu'il y aurait quelque chose comme un milliard de personnes qui sont sorties de la pauvreté au cours des 10-15 dernières années, suite au Millennium Objective et puis ces choses-là. Évidemment, ils sont sortis de la pauvreté, on connaît ça par l'approche de modernisation, qui ont consommé évidemment plus de ressources de la planète et puis aussi vont polluer davantage. J'essaie de réconcilier cette bonne nouvelle des gens qui vivent plus longtemps en meilleure santé avec le coût à la planète de cette amélioration des conditions de vie d'un milliard de personnes. Et j'ai de la misère à réconcilier les deux actions ou deux conséquences. Une que je considère bonne, un milliard de personnes de moins dans la pauvreté, il me semble que c'est une bonne nouvelle. Mais il y a un coût à la planète à cette victoire-là. Quand j'écoute ce que vous présentez, ça nous met face à des dilemmes assez importants. On voit qu'il y a trop de monde sur la planète qui utilise trop de ressources, qui pollue trop. Et qui nous amènerait davantage vers une solution à diminuer la démographie ou l'impact de la démographie, l'impact de la modernisation, l'impact des découvertes qui ne vont pas dans le sens d'économiser les ressources de la planète. Donc, qu'est-ce qu'on doit conclure de ça? On est dans une période de transition et que la transition peut prendre deux voies, c'est-à-dire l'une qui est l'échéance totale versus l'autre.
Reconciliation between the fact that the good news for the past 20 years is that millions of people have been lifted out of poverty, but to the expense of consumption, economic growth. So with this grim, pessimistic scenario of the Anthropocene, so how do you reconcile this good news with the bad news? So is the solution population control, or the solution economic control, or are we in some kind of transition, or what's the meaning of that?
Yeah. The problem that we face, and you will all, I hope, be very familiar with that quite famous graph of life expectancy and GDP per capita. And in the initial phase of that, the graph rises very steeply. You have to have sufficient economic development to afford, as a society, to buy clean water, sanitation, universal education, adequate shelter, all of that. So initially, that curve rises steeply. As you get more wealth per capita, you meet that. then at around between $10,000 and $20,000 per capita of GDP at the moment, that curve starts to inflect. And by the time you get out past 20,000, it's pretty horizontal, which means adding more stuff, because that's really what we're talking about, is stuff. Adding more stuff to what we already have doesn't improve life expectancy, doesn't even improve quality of life particularly. And so we are going to have to find a way, because we've already exceeded the carrying capacity of the planet, the only way that you can create space for the development that is needed in low-income countries and communities is by those who have a lot, or really, if you like, have too much, consuming less. We can't grow our way out of this. We actually will grow our way into a bigger problem. So we have to do less. So what we have to, and the trick is, and this is what the Great Transition is about, is how do we shift from a high quality of life, high consumption society to a high quality of life, low consumption society. We don't want to be giving up our quality of life. What we need to be changing is our quantity of life, if you like, our material well-being, in some very specific ways. And it's not going to work. I mean, if you've ever gone into a low-income country or middle-income country, for that matter, and said, sorry, folks, the planet's small, you can't have what we've got. That doesn't fly. It's never going to fly. Why should it fly? And so we're going to have to figure out how do we scale back our material demands, part of which may be just through better use of technology to be much more efficient in the way we use stuff. But also, you know, do we really need all the toys and gimmicks? I was just I just came back a couple of weeks ago from Malaysia, from Sarawak. And it was a very powerful and moving experience because I had the opportunity, I was there for a conference on healthy cities, but I had the opportunity to go back to a small community near the capital where I had been a volunteer teacher 50 years ago. And I met with some of the quote-unquote kids that I taught 50 years ago who are now in their 60s and retired with grandkids and so on. Kuching, the capital, kind of looks like California in some ways now, particularly in the outer areas. So suburban sprawl, California-style housing, lousy public transit, cars everywhere. They have the same problems we have. They are materially better off, but they're also better off in human development terms. I mean, the kids I taught, growing up in places that, in kampongs and in longhouses, where they didn't have electricity, they didn't have running water other than in the creek, they only had some of the benefits of immunization, for example, and other public health measures. When I was in Sarawak in the 60s, the literacy rate in 1963 was 50%. So we've checked that it's changed hugely. They're very happy with where they are, and Malaysia intends to be and will be a high-income country by 2020. So you're not going to stop that process exactly, but we're going to have to find a way to people talk about a convergence. So we're going to have to use less for others to use more. And that's not an easy sell, but it's what we have to do. And I mean, I think there's two ways that will happen. It'll either happen because we figure out how to do it and do it nicely, or it'll happen because we hit some tipping points and nature does it to us, and that will be a lot nastier.
Bonjour, my name is Julie Lévesque. I'm working for the Réseau Québécois de Village en Santé. We already know that we have to work with cities, we have to influence public policies. I'm wondering if to really have more impact on everything you just presented, if public health institutions should work better with business community. And I would like to hear from you, because I don't think we're working a lot with the business community. Maybe a little bit, but maybe we should work better. And I would like to hear from you.
Well, I think we do, but I think pick your business. I wrote an article about 20, 25 years ago now called Caveat Partner, Beware of Your Partner, because there are all sorts of ways in which the private sector makes more money that are harmful to health. They sell unhealthy products, junk food or whatever it may be. They drive down wages. They avoid regulation, environmental regulation as much as possible, on and on and on. So those kind of companies you don't want to partner with. So it's not just you don't want to partner with the tobacco industry. There's huge sectors of the private sector you don't want to partner with unless they change their ways, because their bottom line and our bottom line is not the same. And so what I talked about in the article was we have to figure out which are the businesses that make money while improving health. And those are the ones you partner with. Those are the ones you want to grow. Mm-hmm. So I think the whole area of social entrepreneurship, of sort of new environmental models for business, of social responsibility and all that, some of that is greenwashing, we know that. Some of that is just flim-flam to look good for the shareholders. But some of it's real. And so we have to be very discerning about who we partner with. But I do think we need to partner with. I have no problem with people making money while improving the world. We want to partner with them. But it means that their bottom line has to be more than, I talk about, there's five forms of capital. Okay, so there's economic capital, social capital, human capital, natural capital, and some people say separately built capital, this building, for example. You need, I'll just finish that phrase. So you, what we need, I talk to businesses, I say real capitalists in the 21st century are not the people who maximize economic capital while damaging those other forms of capital. The real capitalists in the 21st century are the ones who will grow all five forms of capital at the same time. And how do you do that? And there are examples out there.
First, I would like to maybe commentary about what everybody can say about COSEC, about also, you know, the GDP that, about the GDP that you think that's measuring, you know, the economy, you know, very well. You know, I agree with that. And, but I have one small thing to know about when you say we have to shift, you know, from a community, you know, with high consumption to lower consumption. And I think now in time, in our book, you know, just like I was saying, everything shifts, you know, something. We have to move from society, you know, where we are things for granted society to a person oriented society. You know, that's more suggested what I'd like to say. And on this graph, you know, the only thing, you know, our graph, you know, will ask, you know, what's the place, you know, of poverty? I mean, people who are making decisions or taking decisions about everything. I think on probably, you know, where do you put those people in this world?
Okay, well, in terms of moving to a more human-centered society, I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of my favorite definitions of a healthy community comes from a guy called Jim Rouse, who was a developer in the US who developed a community there in the 50s and 60s called Columbia in Maryland. And his, Len Dool worked with him as a consultant. I wrote the original background paper on healthy cities with Len 30 years ago. Actually, 30 years ago this month, come to think of it. But anyway, he worked with Jim Rouse, and he said that Jim Rouse at one point said to his design team, "I want you to build me a garden to grow people in." I think that's a really interesting way to think about what a community is, that you're growing people. So success is maximizing human development and human potential, not economic development and economic potential. To the extent economic development helps you do that, that's good. To the extent it doesn't, it's bad. So we need to shift the focus of that. And unfortunately, we do have a system that has emphasized economic growth, economic development, economic everything. And we've elected governments that think that way. So they think the business of government is business. And when I talk to municipalities, I say, the business, and municipalities, interestingly enough, get this. much more so than national and provincial governments. So national and provincial governments still think it's about GDP and the economy. Municipal governments, they measure quality of life. I don't know any municipal government that measures GDP and uses that to navigate by. But they measure quality of life, and they have quite sophisticated systems for measuring quality of life, much more so than anything the federal or provincial governments do. So we actually need to get those higher levels of government to learn from local levels of government. And that's not easy, because they always think they're best up there. But municipalities do put people at the center, because it's much more their lived experience on a daily basis. And it's not perfect. Nothing's ever perfect. But it's a lot better than happens at national level and provincial level. So we need to put people at the center. We need to measure success in terms of human development. And that's a big mind shift from the way we are right now. But as I said, it was a big mind shift to accept you couldn't smoke in here 30 years ago. We can do it.